The following is audio from Fellowship Community Church in Centennial, Colorado. If you would like more resources or want to support this ministry, please visit www.fcchurch.org.
All right, so we are continuing with our study in the Psalms, and I don't have my clicker. So whoever is running the PowerPoint in the back, I am sorry. All right. So we are continuing our study on a summer in the Psalms. And so each week we have been taking a different genre of Psalm and explaining it a little bit. And so one of the things that that we've been doing is exploring what the differences are in those genres. And so kind of like music or movies, there's different genres. And so this morning, we're going to be looking at Psalms of Thanksgiving. Next week, Pastor Rick will be back from vacation, and he is going to be going through a Psalm of Praise. And so you may be thinking, that feels really close to one another. Like, what is the difference between a Psalm of Thanksgiving and a Psalm of Praise? And they are very similar, but there's some slight differences. And so a way to think about this is if I were to tell you back in the day, oh, it was under my water bottle. The Lord has provided. Let us sing a psalm of thanksgiving. I saw David leave to get one. He's going to be so frustrated. All right. So we are, so if my grandma was a really great chef, a really great cook. And she was. She was so good, the rest of our family stopped trying. Right? And so I could tell you about it, about how she was so meticulous with the way flavor combinations work together and how she would just try and pick apart a recipe until it was perfect. And you could be like, that's really interesting. But if I told you my grandma just made a German chocolate cake, you'd be like, well, I should probably try it. Let's see how those characteristics you shared about your grandma play out in my life. That's kind of the difference between a psalm of praise and a psalm of thanksgiving. A psalm of praise is praising God, worshiping him for who he is, his attributes, his characteristics, the fact that he is holy and he is worthy of our worship. And it is a good and right thing to worship him just because he is. A psalm of thanksgiving is worshiping God because the way that his attributes and his characteristics and who he is has played out in our lives as he has rescued us or redeemed us or helped us in some way. And so it's the difference is worshiping for who he is and then worshiping for what he's done. That's kind of the difference between a psalm of praise and a psalm of thanksgiving. And so up here, we're going to be looking at, it's supposed to be taste and see, by the way. Not Taze and C. Security got real excited when they saw that typo. Like, yeah, someone should try. We'll Taze and C. All right, so that was a total accident. But some themes of Thanksgiving Psalms. In a Thanksgiving Psalm, there's a cry for help or deliverance. Or there may be a testimony about God's deliverance. And so one of those two things tend to exist. Okay, so David finds himself in a lot of situations where he needs help. He needs help being delivered, and God always shows up. He delivers. And so the beautiful thing about these psalms is some of them, it's like they're written in faith. Lord, please deliver me. And then the Lord has delivered me. And so we'll see an element of that. And then there's a vow or a promise to worship God because of what he's done. Because he has rescued, because he has redeemed, because he has reconciled, so we vow to worship him because of that. And so I'm going to shift this. I feel like my microphone is all over my face, and this is really professional. Okay, there we go. So those are the themes or the characteristics of a Thanksgiving psalm. And so when we read those, sometimes we'll wonder as we read a Thanksgiving psalm, what is this rooted in? Like, what story is this rooted in? And we don't always have the answer. Here's a list of several Thanksgiving psalms. There's a lot of them. And we're going to take turns reading them around the room. But there's a lot of Thanksgiving psalms. In fact, the one that we're looking at today, Psalm 34, is not listed up here. But we want to know what happened here. How did this come about? And so Psalm 34 is really great because it lets us know. Some of you might have a song that you really love, and when you hear the backstory on it, you're like, I love it even more. Or you hear the backstory on it and you're like, oh, I wish it had a more beautiful background, right? Eric Clapton wrote a song called Beautiful Tonight. Man, it's a really sweet song. Sounds wonderful. Don't ever play it as like a first dance at a wedding because it was written about someone else's wife. Sorry to suck the meaning out of that for you if you really loved that song. Lately, if you've been watching the World Cup, and I know a lot of you are, and some of you don't care at all about soccer, but if you are watching the World Cup, you know that there is a song that has kind of become the anthem of the U.S. men's national team. There's a great video of the whole crowd singing Country Roads, Take Me Home. After the U.S. has won a match, which is how you say game in soccer or football. And so after the match, they're singing the song. I would show you a clip, but I'm afraid that because of copyright reasons, and they would review it and give me an unnecessary red card. And so, but I do encourage you to go look that. It's really cool. But part of me kind of wondered, like, why is this the song? The song about West Virginia. Maybe. Someone's excited about West Virginia. We're all, you know, these players are from all over our country, probably everywhere but West Virginia. And so we're going to make this the song. But if you get into the song, people will have, there's a debate that happens. Is this about West Virginia or is this about Western Virginia? Like the state. Because you see like Shenandoah River, Blue Ridge Mountains, those are located in the western side of the state of Virginia. They're not in West Virginia. And so people will have these debates because it also just says like West Virginia is in the song. And it's funny watching that just devolve into like this, you know, YouTube hate fest comment section thing. When the reality is, and this is something I think is really funny, it's not really about either one. The people who wrote the song, there was two guys that wrote the song, both from the Northeast, but not Virginia or West Virginia. They were on a road trip in Maryland. And one of them was looking out at these back roads in Maryland and thinking about the back roads where he grew up in Massachusetts. And that was the inspiration for the song. But Maryland and Massachusetts are harder to work into a song. So let's find something else. We'll pick West Virginia. Maybe these places are in West Virginia. We don't know. We're going to plug it all into the song. We've made it work. We're going to pitch it to Johnny Cash, and he would have made it a banger. But instead, they're like, well, we know this other guy from New Mexico who goes by the name Denver, even though that's not his last name. He changed it because he loved Colorado. He went to school in West Texas, Reckham Tech. And we'll have him help come finish it. And then it turns into this really great song. And so then all of a sudden, when you hear like, oh, this is a really random backstory for a song that name drops West Virginia and has very little to do with it. But when you think about, well, two guys from driving through Maryland, thinking about growing up in Massachusetts, get a guy from New Mexico who went to school in West Texas, who changed his name to Colorado. It makes sense that we would sing that for the U.S. men's national team. We've got the whole nation incorporate, right? So I just think that that's kind of fun, but this song gives us exactly what event took place that caused David to write it. So we get the backstory, and that's helpful. Okay, so we're going to read about a crazy king, because at the top of Psalm 34, and we're going to read it here in a moment, actually, but it says in verse 0 is what some people call it, which I think is kind of a cool way of making it seem neat. But of David, the Psalm of David, when he changed his behavior before Abimelech, so that he drove him out and he went away. And so before we read the backstory, I want to read the song itself, the psalm itself. So if you'll follow along in Psalm 34, we're going to read the whole thing. And I know that it's long, but it's important. So if you'll follow along with me, Psalm 34, I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me, and delivered me from all my fears. Those who look to him are radiant, and their faces shall never be ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him, and saved him out of all of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Oh, fear the Lord, you his saints, for those who fear him have no lack. The young lions suffer want and hunger, and those who seek the Lord lack no good thing, Come, O children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. What man is there who desires life and loves many days, that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears toward their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. When the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all his bones, not one of them is broken. Affliction will slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the life of his servants. None of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. So this is the psalm that David wrote right after this experience where he is put in a situation where he acts like a crazy person. All right. And this is not like kind of being hyperbolic about what happens in this passage. There are a few stories in the life of David that don't tend to make the children's Bible books. This is one of them. Like the last few weeks, you've noticed Chris Winkler and Bev Holtzum have been repainting our children's hall and kind of giving that an update, fresh coat of paint. And in there, there's some stories that like the life of Jesus and then some other Old Testament stories, Noah and the Ark, you know, Noah's Ark and parting of the Red Sea. And you get to the life of David. And if you're going to put up something in a children's hall from the life of David, it's going to be David and Goliath. It's not going to be him drooling over his beard and writing crazy stuff on the wall, right? We never put those up. But that's the story that we're in. So 1 Samuel 21, we see this. So this is what's happened. So David rose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Okay, so really quick, this is the start of the time when David is on the run, when he's in the wilderness. This is when he's officially left Saul because Saul has tried to kill him. Saul tried to kill Jonathan for defending David. Saul's is a crazy person. That may have been some of the inspiration for David. So David flees and he goes, he stops in Nob. He talks to the priests of Nob. Again, if you're reading Old Testament stories to your kids, that's a great one because Nob is one of the easiest to pronounce Old Testament cities. Okay, so he goes to the priest of Nob and he says, "Hey, I'm on a mission from the king. I had to really fast. I don't have a weapon. What do you have?" He goes, "Well, we have this sword that you took from Goliath, and we have it here wrapped in a cloth. Take this." So now the only weapon that David has is Goliath's sword, and he flees to Gath, Goliath's hometown, and is walking through with that as his weapon. And he is recognized. It says, "And the servants of Achish said to him, 'Is not this David, the king of the land? Did they not sing to one another of him in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s.' And David took these words to heart and was much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them and pretended to be insane in their hands and made marks on the doors of the gate and let his spittle run down in his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, 'Behold, you see the man is mad. Why then have you brought him to me? Do I like madmen? what you have brought, that you've brought this fellow to behave as a madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? And so Achish, and if you notice, it says at the beginning of Psalm 34, Abimelech. So Abimelech is the title, and Achish is the name. So Abimelech would be like Caesar, and the name would be Augustine. So it's Abimelech and Achish. Okay, so the same guy. And so Achish has David kind of brought before him, and David's acting like a crazy person. Because at the time, the view was, if someone's acting crazy, they've been afflicted by the gods. So you just kind of leave them alone. Like they've had enough punishment. And that was this calculated move by David. If I act like a crazy person, maybe he won't kill me because I've killed a lot of them, including Goliath. And now I'm walking in with his sword, this kind of broadcasting, I don't really belong here, right? A few weeks ago, we were coming back from Camp Maranatha and we stopped for lunch. And there was a McDonald's and a Dairy Queen and a Taco Bell. And part of our group went to Dairy Queen. And then they came back to eat their food at McDonald's. And you could tell who the rule followers were. They're like, you can't do that. We're in McDonald's. You can't bring Dairy Queen in here. And it's like, this is McDonald's. Like, no one's paying attention, right? Like, you can eat whatever. But it kind of broadcasts like, hey, this is from somewhere else. Like, David's coming in and it's clear he is from somewhere else. He's holding Goliath's sword. So they know who he is. The song that they reference, that Saul has killed his thousands, David his tens of thousands. Like, that was a jam in the day. Like, people knew it. It had gotten out there. And so even in Gath, they're hearing about this. And so they bring him before Abimelech or before Achish. He acts crazy. Achish does what a lot of leaders probably do, which is like, I got enough crazy people to worry about. Like, why are you bringing this madman in front of me? Just let him go. And so David leaves and he flees to the cave of Adullam. And so most scholars believe that this psalm, Psalm 34, was written in this cave. And so some believe it may have been after his time in the wilderness and exile. But most kind of believe that it was written in this time frame where he's at this cave hiding out. And so that's where we can hop into this psalm, see how it breaks down, and how, for me, I believe it actually was written in the cave of Adullam. It makes sense to me and how things are written and what has transpired. Okay, and so with that, we're going to talk about a thankful king. All right, so Psalm is thanking God. I mean, so David is thanking God in this psalm for what he has done, for how he has delivered David from what seemed to be certain death, what was a scary situation. And so there's a real simple outline, I think, for this psalm, which is this. There's an intent that David shares. There's a testimony about what God has done. There's an invitation for others to come and enjoy that, those truths, and experience that. And then there's him worshiping, which is what he intends to do. All right, so it becomes full circle in this. And so this psalm is written, it's an acrostic psalm, which for me paints the picture of it's just another reason I think it was written in that cave. David was just acting like a crazy person, scribbling random stuff on the wall, drooling all over himself, really kingly stuff, right? And so because he's acting crazy, and then he flees, and so he wants to write this well-structured, organized psalm. This is an acrostic psalm. It takes the Hebrew alphabet, and it kind of lays it out. It's like the ABCs of the Hebrew language, and that's a learning technique. It's an educational type of thing. It helps to recall with your memory what these truths are that are laid out in this psalm. And so as he lays this out in this well-structured way in response to having just acted like a crazy person, like, you know, he's still in his right mind. He's writing this out in this ABC format. We have this a lot, right? We'll talk about, it's the ABCs of sales, which is always be closing, right? Or the ABCs of Southern hospitality, always bring casserole. right? Like that, we have these ABCs of whatever. So this is what David's doing. It's these ABCs of thanking God for his deliverance. And so in these first three verses, we see his intent played out. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth or on my lips. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me and let us exalt his name together. So the intent is I'm going to worship God. I want you to join me. I'm going to make much of God. I'm going to magnify the name of the Lord. I want you to do that with me. So, and even that the phrase magnify there, it's not, I've always loved this picture of it. It's not like a microscope, but a telescope. Right, so a microscope makes something really small seem bigger so we can see the details in it. Whereas a telescope takes something that's really big, but really far away, seem closer to its actual size. And so this is that kind of magnify. I'm going to magnify the, or come magnify the Lord with me. Let us make much of him because he is worth being made much of. We won't even get close, but let's try. Let's magnify the Lord together. And even as he starts off, his praise will be continually in my mouth or on my lips. It's hard for me to imagine David writing this without thinking about the fact that he was just drooling all over himself, just letting spittle run down his beard and not thinking like, I want my mouth to not overflow with drool. I want it to overflow with praise. I want that to be what's constantly in my mind and on my mouth as I'm fleshing this out. And so then after this intent is stated, verses 4-7, we see the testimony. David says, I sought the Lord and he answered me and delivered me from all my fears. Those who look to him are radiant and their faces shall never be put to shame. This poor man cried and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all this trouble. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. That term sought at the beginning, just to make sure we're on the same page, that's the Hebrew word darash. Okay, so that word is more about seeking counsel than seeking your car keys. All right, like it is, it's not, I wonder where the Lord is. It's like, I'm seeking his counsel. I'm seeking him out and he hears me and he answers me. It's not, I don't know where God is. I need to find him. That's not what's happening with David here. So I'm seeking the Lord. I'm seeking his counsel and he answers me and he delivers me from my fears. And then I love verse 5. Those who look to him are radiant and their faces shall never be ashamed. A lot of translations, and there's some tension over the translation and how it should be written, but there's a lot of translations that actually think verse 5 is less, you'll never be put to shame, be ashamed as a promise, and more as a command. Like, hey, if you look to the Lord, your face is radiant, don't be ashamed. Never be ashamed because those who look to the Lord are radiant. And so this testimony about how David cries out to the Lord and the Lord answers and the Lord delivers. And then it shifts into this invitation. Verse 8, the one verse that we all know from this psalm. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Oh, fear the Lord, you his saints, for those who fear him have no lack. The young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. And he's going to go on. He goes, come, O children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. What man is there who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. I love this psalm. It is definitely a Thanksgiving psalm. All right, but and I know I used the same illustration a few years ago, but it's kind of like Princess Bride. It's got a lot of different elements to it, right? There's some wisdom in here. There's a little bit of imprecatory in here, right? There's worship. There's thanking God for what he's done. And so as David shifts and he gives this invitation, taste and see that the Lord is good. Don't just hear about it. Experience it. for yourselves. Don't let me just tell you how great of a cake my grandma can bake. Cut off a slice, right? Like, taste and see, experience his goodness, experience it in your lives. Don't think that all the characteristics and attributes of God have no impact on your life, because he is a God who moves in. He's a God whose characteristics and his attributes inform how he interacts with your life. And so David is encouraging him, come taste and see and fear the Lord. And when we think of that shift, it can almost seem off-putting. Like, taste and see that the Lord is good and fear him. I'll teach you how to fear him. Does that feel weird to you, to think like, I need to learn to fear God? We do. And the fear of the Lord, it's not about multiplying fear. It's actually about eliminating fear. Because if you fear the Lord, if you know the God who spoke all of creation into existence, the one who rescued and redeemed me, the one who lays out all of my days, the one who rules and reigns rightly over all creation, if I fear him, why would I fear anything else? There's nothing that brings my fear, that would overrun that fear of God. And so it's this invitation to limit your fear, to know that God is the only one who's big enough to really be feared. And he loves us, and he hears us, and he delivers us, and he's our safe place. He's our refuge. And so if our safe place is bigger than all of our fears, man, we are blessed. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Taste and see that he is good. And as he lays out how to fear the Lord, verses 13 and 14, they're really practical. He says, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. And so I love this picture that David gives. He doesn't say, hey, the fear of the Lord is not doing evil. But sometimes we think it is. Like, I've turned away from evil, and so now I'm gonna navel gaze and not do anything, but I'm not doing evil. So I'm okay just being stagnant and not doing anything. It doesn't say it. It says, no, turn away from evil and do good. Like, seek peace isn't just pull back from everything and avoid all conflict. Seek peace and pursue it. The pursuit of peace might mean that there's some conflict. It might mean that there's some hard conversations as you seek peace together. Right, so David is giving these really practical ways, like, here's how you live in the fear of the Lord. You know, Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the peacemakers, they will be children of God. I love that one of the hardest things we're called to do is to make peace, and we get this promise of, but you're children of God, the one who spoke everything into existence, the only one that's worthy of our fear and our adoration and our love. You're his children. Peter, 1 Peter chapter 3, he quotes this psalm when he's talking about how do you live in a world where you only fear God, that you only fear what God is doing, and you worship him only, and he is the ultimate in your life, and you're making much of Jesus, which means you're going to treat other people in a certain way. You're going to be kind to them. You're going to treat them in the way that this speaks to. And you're not going to worry about how they're going to view you in the midst of it. Right? Sometimes we take, right after he quotes this psalm, we tend to pull the verse out of 1 Peter of, hey, always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have. So, like, I'm going to be prepared to give that answer, but I'm not going to display that hope. Because if I display that hope, people will ask, and then I have to give an answer. It's both. So Peter lays this out. Hey, here's how you do it. You fear the Lord. You seek this good life, that you keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. You turn away from evil and you do good. You seek peace and you pursue it. And not just in 2026 Colorado, but through all of human history, people that seek peace and pursue it have turned heads. It's not the normal thing. So as we seek him, as we're invited into this by David, we get this beautiful picture of fear, and then that turns into why we worship him. So verse 15 to the end of the psalm says, "The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears toward their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. When the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all of his bones. Not one of them is broken. Affliction will slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the life of his servants. None of those who take refuge in him will be condemned." So there's this promise in here that the Lord will deliver his saints, the righteous ones, from their afflictions. That doesn't mean that we won't have afflictions. We live in a broken world. We're going to experience afflictions. Sometimes God will deliver you from them in the sense of removing that affliction. Sometimes he delivers you through them by taking you through the affliction, and you rely more on him, and then you get more of God. And that's a beautiful thing. So you have this promise put on display and this invitation. So as you look at the structure of it, how does David go from a man on the run by himself in Gath, acting like a crazy person, and then running to live in a cave, to inviting other people to join him because of what God has done? So if you go back to 1 Samuel 22, right after he's left Abimelech or Achish, says David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him. And he became commander over them. And there were with him about 400 men. So David flees to this cave. And as he's writing this psalm, or the context of where the psalm is written, this is who's joining him. People that are in debt, right? People that are, I love that it says everyone who's bitter in soul, like they're discontent, or if they're in distress. So the in debt, the distressed, the discontented are gathering to David in the cave of Adullam. And he leads them, but before leading them to battle, he leads them in worship. He says, "I'm going to bless the Lord at all times. Let us come magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together." And he shares his testimony. "The Lord delivered me." And I know it's not in the psalm. I can't imagine that he didn't share that story. It's written down. So the Lord delivered me from Achish and from all these people who recognized me. And now I'm here with you. And my invitation to you is that he can do that for you. This is why we share testimony. This is what we're doing next week. When we go to Cherry Creek State Park next week and people are being baptized, we are declaring the saving work of Jesus in their lives to whoever is around. Jesus saved me. He can save you too. Jesus did this work for me. He did this work for you also. It's why we record the video, the testimony videos, because what God has done for you is not just for you, it is for us. We need to hear each other's stories of how God has rescued, how God has redeemed, how God has reconciled you to himself. There are people that need to hear that, both people who have put their faith in Jesus and those who haven't yet. And so our testimony is not just something we keep. We share that and we invite others into it. We see We see David doing just that. And so as these discontented and in debt and distressed people are making their way, David invites them in to experience, hey, you're in this spot. You're in debt. You owe people. You're distressed. Like you are uncomfortable with what's happening with Saul, and you're on the run because that makes you really nervous and upset. And now you're here, or you're discontented. I love like how the ESV puts it. You're bitter in soul. You're angry. Nothing's going right and you're here. I want to encourage you. Don't just hear about this God, but taste and see. Taste and see that he is good. Taste and see as you experience his love and his mercy in your life, that he's worthy of our worship. This psalm is also quoted in John 19, 36 says, "For these things took place that scripture might be fulfilled." After talking about the crucifixion, not one of his bones would be broken. As Jesus dies on the cross, before the soldiers come by to break the legs of those that were still alive, Jesus is already gone. So this psalm that David wrote about finding our refuge in the Lord and his redeeming work and how he will redeem the righteous gets quoted by John as a prophetic verse about Jesus never breaking a bone. I think it's beautiful that David is pointing us forward to the cross of Christ. He's pointing us forward to what Jesus has done for us so that we can really truly say with verse 8, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. A few weeks ago, I talked about that word blessed that we translate as blessed. And there's two Hebrew words for it. There's Ashrei and there's Baruch. And so Baruch is the like when you see someone who's blessed by God, like you're observing how blessed they are. And then Ashrei is the experience of being blessed itself. So Psalm 1 had Baruch in it. Like you can see the difference in someone's life. This is the word Ashrei. This is taste and see, experience for yourself, experience the blessedness that can come to you through Jesus, through God and only God. Blessed are those who take refuge in him. How happy are those who take refuge in him? What else would they have to fear? And so for us this morning, I want us to be reminded as we think about this crazy king. I'm gonna move past taste and see because I feel like that's gonna just throw everybody. But as we think about this psalm written by a king, even though he was actively on the run, the people of Gath recognized him as king of the land, who humiliated himself. He drooled all over himself, was called crazy, had accusations thrown at him that weren't true, so that way he could escape. We see these shadows of our redeeming king, who was humiliated and humbled. And he had unfair accusations thrown at him, and he took it. He didn't just have drool and spit running down his beard. He had blood. He had other people's spit running through his beard. And he endured it, not to save himself, but to save us. To reconcile us back to himself. He goes to the cross, where he gives up his life without breaking a bone, so we could be redeemed, so we could take refuge in him.
You've been listening to audio from Fellowship Community Church in Centennial, Colorado. If you'd like more resources or want to support this ministry, please visit www.fcchurch.org.